Current State on WKAR. The city of Lansing is commemorating an important event in labor history. On June 7, 1937, businesses and factories in the city were shut down by what has come to be known as the Lansing Labor Holiday. Labor leaders were seeking the release of workers at Capital City Wrecking who had been arrested for their organizing efforts. The impact was immediate. Governor Frank Murphy intervened, the holiday ended by nightfall, and Capital City Wrecking negotiated a union contract. The 80th anniversary is being marked with the dedication of a new historical marker on the plaza in front of City Hall this weekend. WKAR Scott Pohl talks with MSU History Professor Lisa Fine and MSU Human Resources and Labor Relations Professor John Beck about the Lansing Labor Holiday, which Fine describes as a rarity, a general strike.
The one that occurred in Lansing resulted from a variety of local as well as national and in some cases even international circumstances. It was comparatively short and comparatively peaceful, but nevertheless, it accomplished what it set out to do, which was to finally and formally, allow labor organizing to take place and to take foothold in the city of Lansing.
General strike. Let's define that. I assume by that you mean that it wasn't just members of one union or members of one union local.
General strikes are a phenomenon where there is a spark of some sort that leads to an entire citywide or region-wide end of work. That is, that normally a strike happens in one location, and out of solidarity, other people lay down their tools, or often, as in the case of Lansing, some of the strikers go from business to business and really to ask them or demand that they close down for the day or for longer, if it was a longer strike. In the case of the Lansing labor holiday, it was only a one-day general strike. And those businesses normally comply because these strikers are their neighbors, these strikers are their patrons. These strikers often very well may be related to people who either are running the business or working at that business. So on June 7th, 1937, events sparked this overall general strike in the city, a city that it was not necessarily known as a hotbed of labor radicalism, as a hotbed of labor organizing.
So June 7th, 1937, to what extent was this general strike planned as opposed to the sun came up and word just began to spread like wildfire, let's do this and let's do it now?
This was, as in the words of the individual for whom it's who is held responsible for this, it was a completely spontaneous event. There was nothing premeditated or planned about it. Lansing was not the hotbed of labor radicalism or labor activism to the same extent that Flint was. Nevertheless, as a result of the larger national organizing that went on after the passage of the Wagner Act in 1935, which is considered labor's Magna Carta, like the rest of the auto industry, as well as many others in the Detroit area, the workers in Lansing began to organize, in particular, the very large number of auto workers. And in March and April of 37, the Rio Motor Car Company, which was one of the major employers, held one of its successful sit-down strikes and brought the UIW not only to that particular plant, but also to the city, because it was a big amalgamated union. So many of the other auto workers were included in their union. The immediate instigation for this Lansing labor holiday, however, was a strike that was taking place at a much smaller company called the Capital Wrecking Company. Maybe a couple of dozen people working there. They wanted to join the union. They set up some picket lines when the management was intransigent and wouldn't cooperate. And it was as a result of the authorities of the city of Lansing arresting individuals who had been participating in this picket despite an injunction in the middle of the night, including the wives of some of the organizers in the union, that prompted the immediate response that became the Lansing labor holiday. Lester Washburn, who was the head of the union in Rio, who became the head of the amalgamated UAW Local 182, basically decided when he came back, he was out of town and he came back and discovered what had happened. His wife, A number of other labor leaders and some of their wives had been arrested overnight. When he discovered what had happened, he said, that's it, we're going to shut the city down. So it was a completely spontaneous event that occurred as a result of these actions on the part of the authorities in the city of Lansing itself, the sheriff in particular. And it succeeded.
I want to describe the scene, because when we hear that the city was shut down, we think of empty streets. That's the opposite of what happened here. Can you set the scene for us?
Partially the way that the strikers carried off this general strike in downtown Lansing was they took cars and trucks, in some cases 18-wheelers, I mean, you know, fairly large vehicles, and they parked them downtown in the middle of the street, locked them, and simply walked away. And they in effect, totally clogged the major streets, Michigan Avenue, Washington Avenue. And by clogging up those streets, you couldn't get other vehicles in. The people who had just locked their cars and walked away, in effect, were downtown already. And it was really the locus of where the strike went on was right in the middle of downtown Lansing, right at the state capitol and in those specific streets. So it grew throughout the day in terms of the amount of people that were, you know, coming down to join in the protest.
Were those workers freed?
Yes. The general strike was successful in two important regards, really the only two regards that it had been really created to obtain. Number one, that the people were let out of jail. And number two, ultimately, the small company, Capital City Racking, actually negotiated and finished a contract within a matter of days after the actual Lansing labor holiday. One thing that's very interesting when you see photos of the day, you don't see picket signs, you don't see any form of kind of radical flags. The only thing that you see in this entire sea of striking individuals are American flags. And so these were folks who believed very, very strongly in the fact that their government had passed a law in 1935 that said it was legal, and wasn't only legal, that it was the policy of the United States to actually back the notion of collective bargaining.
MSU professors John Beck and Lisa Fine talking with WKAR's Scott Pohl about the Lansing labor holiday 80 years ago this week. The Lansing Historical Society has opened an exhibit focusing on the year 1937 in the lobby of Lansing City Hall.
We shall not be forced by the tree. Let's stand by the water. We shall not be.
It's Current State on WKAR. Part of this weekend's Be a Tourist in Your Own Town in Lansing might be a trip to the R.E. Olds Transportation Museum. Ransom Olds founded the Olds Motor Vehicle Company in Lansing in 1897. The company was bought by General Motors in 1908, which produced the Oldsmobile brand for 96 years. Ransom Olds continued to produce cars under the name REO Motor Car Company. Bill Adcock is the executive director of the R.E. Olds Transportation Museum. Bill, join me for a tour of the museum and a history of the man.
Ari came here when he was a kid, maybe 16 years old, with his parents. And his dad had a machine shop here. He built stationary engines and repaired engines and so forth. They were stationary engines. And it would be, everybody had a stationary engine. If you were a farmer, if you had a garage, you would power everything with that, whether it was a grinder, a saw, you could power your washing machine with that. So even the ladies would have use for a stationary engine.
So what we see at the beginning of the museum is a collection of these engines that were part of everyday life, from the home to, as you said, to the farm to lumber mills.
That's correct. And as things got bigger and better, so did the stationary engines. They went from steam to gasoline. And we have an example here in the corner. It's huge. It's as big as a car, bigger than a car. It's only 18 horsepower, though, but it would run a small factory. That's how he got his start. he didn't really like horses at all, and so he thought there was a better way, and he built his first steam-powered car, 1886, I believe. He was probably the founder of the automobile industry as we know it. Everybody says Henry Ford was that, and it wasn't. He was building cars. In 1897, he built his first car. We have the car right here. And then over here, this is the first steam car he built in that period of 1883-1887. Didn't work so well. But in 1897, he built his first gas-powered car. It was basically a carriage. They put tiller steering on it. And we have the one and only copy. They built four of them, so I guess it was a production, mass-produced, even though it was four copies. One is left today. We have it behind glass. It belongs to the Smithsonian, but it's on loan. We have a three-year lease on that, so to speak. We have to keep that in an environmentally controlled atmosphere, so it has to be 70 degrees all the time, 50% humidity, and not much light in there either.
Young Johnny Steele has an Oldsmobile. He loves a dear little girl. She is the queen of his gas machine. She has his heart in a whirl. Now when they go for a spin, you know, he tries to learn the auto store. He lifts her steer while he gets her ear and whispers soft and low, "Come away with me, Lucille, in my merry Oldsmobile down the road."
Bill, this is what most people probably imagine in their minds when you think of that first automobile, and this is really one of the first ones. It's a carriage, old carriage-style black body, four wheels, the tiller steering, as you described, and the leaf springs on the front and then two in the back.
Mm-hmm. And they're different than the leaf springs we know today.
This is Peter Worf for Current State. We're talking with Bill Adcock, the executive director of the R.E. Olds Transportation Museum in Lansing.
2 years later, he built his first electric car. This is they built four of them again. This is the only example left in the world. And this is the actual car. Again, it was a carriage style with a tiller steering in it. After this, they said, well, let's build a car company. We know how to build cars. They formed a corporation called Olds Motor Works. Most of it was funded by a guy by the name of Samuel Smith. He was big into copper. They were in Detroit. So they built a factory in Detroit. A few weeks before the production, it burned to the ground. And then a lot of the local people in Lansing, they got together with RE, said, bring your company back here, rebuild it. We want to have the cars be built in Lansing. A lot of good workers here. And so that's what they did. And eventually they rebuilt the factory in Detroit as well. But they produced the curved dash Olds here. Right. 1903, he left the company. He didn't get along with the management very well. They wanted to make big cars. He said, no, this is what we make. We're making thousands of these now, and you're going to make hundreds of the bigger cars. And so he left. He cashed out his stock. He retired, basically, for a few months. A lot of people in Lansing said, hey, you've got to build another car company. You've got all the technology. You're a wizard at this, and we've got to do that. So another company was born with his name. He was going to call it the R.E. Olds Company. They said, you can't do that. We own that intellectual material, that name. So he just used his initials, Ransom Eli Olds, R.E.O., called it the Rio Motor Company, and that's how we know it today as the Rio Motor Company.
Mud every morn, out in an automobile.
Here's a copy here of what would be an original advertisement for one of these curved dash Oldsmobiles. Price $650. Can you tell us about this, Bill?
Well, again, remember I said that he didn't like horses, and that was the purpose of that. It's waving goodbye to those horses as he goes by in his curved dash Olds. You know, he was the first entrepreneur to actually build a mass-produced car, and he built a progressive assembly line. He was friends with Henry Ford. Henry would visit the factory, as a matter of fact, and then Henry got the idea, well, we can put a belt in this thing, or we can put a chain. We can put something that'll draw the car in motion rather than us passing the car one by one. So,
and the sort of the banner for this advertisement is the passing of the horse.
That's correct. And it was, too.
Bill Adcock, he's the executive director of the R.E. Olds Transportation Museum in Lansing. Bill, thanks again for the tour and the time.
Peter, thank you very much.